In this segment, we will discuss summarizing evidence. The idea behind summarizing evidence is that for many tests and treatments, there are multiple studies, such that one study does not tell the whole story. One study may contradict others, or they may complement each other and build up and make a much stronger case. For this reason, there's been a growing trend towards what are called systematic reviews or evidence reports that aim to bring all the evidence on a given test or treatment together. Remember the Haynes 4S model that had studies at its foundation, but then had syntheses and synopses that brought the data together and then made it available to users, particularly clinicians, in a highly digested form. Now, summarizing the evidence is not just going out and collecting a few studies and bringing them together. There are methodologic challenges in summarizing the evidence, and these were recently elucidated in a supplement to the journal Annals of Internal Medicine and make one realize the methodology that's required to do summarization of evidence. So if we're going to create a systematic review, what are the steps? In Guyatt's textbook on evidence-based medicine, the steps in creating a systematic review are described. First, we have to define the question back to the PICO of population, intervention, comparison where appropriate, and outcome. So we have to define the clinical question. We then conduct a literature search. We have to define the information sources we're going to use and come up with a searching strategy. Now, in a systematic review, a literature search is not just typing a few terms into Medline. Again, we have to be very comprehensive to make sure that our literature search casts a broad net and that we retrieve many articles to look at so we can then appropriately include what usually turn out to be a relatively small number of articles. But we have to do the broad literature search so we have the opportunity to evaluate a large number. So then we develop inclusion and exclusion criteria for the articles that we do retrieve in our search. Most steps along the way have measures of reproducibility, so typically the Medline records with their titles and abstracts, as well as the full text articles that are decided to analyze further, are typically done in duplicate, and it's determined whether different individuals evaluating the same article come up with the same judgment. Once we identify the articles that we're going to use in the systematic review, we abstract the data out of them, and then we conduct the analysis. And for example, if we're going to perform a meta-analysis, we determine the method of pooling, explore heterogeneity of the results, so we explore whether some results point in one direction of a treatment and other results point in another. We assess for publication and other types of bias. So what kind of results do we obtain from a systematic review? Well, systematic reviews often use meta-analysis. And we've talked a little bit about meta-analysis. And to describe exactly what it is, it's essentially when you combine the results of multiple studies that are appropriately similar. So if you have multiple studies that have looked at, for example, the use of a treatment in a disease with a certain patient population, it's appropriate to combine those together in a meta-analysis, which in essence gives you more statistical power. You have a larger sample size, it's easier to achieve statistical significance, and you're pooling data from different studies, but studies that are similar. Now, you don't have to do a meta-analysis in a systematic review. In fact, if the studies are too heterogeneous because there's different patient characteristics, different settings, other kinds of factors, it would be inappropriate to combine them in a meta-analysis. In fact, the systematic reviews that I myself have been involved in looking at telemedicine, you can't really do a meta-analysis when one telemedicine study is a dermatology study, the other one is a radiology study, a psychiatry study, etc. So we did a systematic review looking at the evidence for improved patient outcomes or improved ability to do diagnosis using any kind of telemedicine. It would be inappropriate to combine certainly all the studies. It would perhaps have been possible to combine a few studies in some areas, but in the case of telemedicine, these studies were quite heterogeneous. So when we do a meta-analysis, we use a summary measure that gives us an indication of the treatment effect. And we use either the odds ratio or the weighted mean difference, which I'll explain in the next slide. So let's talk a little bit about the meaning of these summary statistics. So the odds ratio. The odds ratio is used for binary events. So many studies are reported in terms of how they reduce certain events that we're trying to avoid, such as death, certain complications of a disease, like the development of a myocardial infarction for someone who has high blood pressure, or the development of kidney disease for someone who has diabetes, or recurrence of a disease, the reemergence of cancer that might occur after initial treatment. Usually, the odds ratio statistic is configured such that when it is less than one, that indicates there's a benefit for treatment. So, and this is the approach, for example, that the Cochrane collaboration, which we'll talk about later in the segment, uses. So when the odds ratio is less than one, then there's benefit for the treatment. And it turns out when the confidence interval does not include the odds ratio equals one line, when it doesn't cross over that line, our results are statistically significant. We can actually calculate in a somewhat complicated formula the number needed to treat from the odds ratio. So we can translate odds ratio findings into something that have a little more meaning from a practical standpoint. The other summary statistic is weighted mean difference. This statistic is used for numeric events, such as measurements. So the blood pressure value, the blood sugar value, the FEV1, which is how much air someone expires in a minute, that is typically reduced in a condition like asthma. The weighted mean difference is usually configured such that a value less than zero indicates that there's a treatment benefit. And a value greater than zero indicates that there's benefit for the control intervention. Just as a value an odds ratio value of greater than one indicates that the control is of more benefit. And again, if the confidence interval crosses over the weighted mean difference equals zero line, or if it doesn't cross over that line, that means the results are statistically significant. So let's look at some examples of systematic reviews. In particular, we'll look at some systematic reviews of treatment of cardiac risk factors. So these are things that we looked at in some of the previous segments, such as the primary prevention of heart disease with statins. In any case, there were a group of meta-analyses that were published in the early part of this decade finding benefits for lowering cholesterol, either with statin drugs or other types of drugs, or other interventions such as diet, blood pressure, and homocysteine. In fact, the combined publication of these meta-analyses led to a proposal for developing a so-called poly pill that would contain six medications, a statin, three blood pressure lowering drugs in half their standard dose, a beta blocker, folic acid, and aspirin. The authors argued that this could potentially reduce cardiovascular disease in Western countries by 80%. Now, not everyone agreed with this, that giving everyone this pill would have this beneficial of an outcome. In fact, many argued that it would need to be subject to a randomized controlled trial. There was much correspondence in the British Medical Journal and elsewhere about the poly pill. And one that had a lot of appeal to me was the notion of a poly meal that would be not only natural and safer, but even tastier, with giving people appropriate dosages of wine, fish, dark chocolate, fruits and vegetables, garlic, and almonds. Sounds good to me. In any case, there actually has been the development of this pill and an initial clinical trial done in India. The trial hasn't gone on long enough yet to look at outcomes, but it has shown that this pill does lower blood pressure and cholesterol beneficially. Well, just as there continue to be clinical trials done looking at interventions to reduce the burden of cardiovascular disease, there continue to be meta-analyses published that incorporate those results. There have been studies, meta-analyses looking at lipid reduction with statins, one of 20 trials published in 2008 looking at primary prevention of cardiovascular disease, found that statins reduced cardiovascular deaths and all deaths with no increased adverse events. Another meta-analysis focused on people who had cardiovascular risk factors but no presence of disease found reduced risk from treatment with statins and improved survival. But there have been some concerns about the widespread use of statins, especially in primary prevention. One concerns a meta-analysis that found a increased risk of development of diabetes for people taking statins. The reason for that is not completely clear. And another concern, getting back to our EBM statistics, is that there is a relatively high number needed to treat for primary prevention of cardiovascular disease. So the relative risk reduction may be pretty good, on the order of, say, 50%, but when the overall risk to the population, which is what we aim for in primary prevention, people who don't yet have the disease, makes it such that the number needed to treat is quite high, depending on the statistics, anywhere from 100 to 500. The reference by Wilson is actually a New York Times article that I find explains this concept very well and does raise some concerns about the widespread use of statins. The evidence for continued benefit of lowering blood pressure continues to be strong. Meta-analysis recently published looking at 147 trials found reduction of coronary heart disease and death from all categories of antihypertensive diseases, whether beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, or whatever. The Wald brothers, however, continue to promote their poly pill. But another interesting study caught my eye recently that looked at a German population and measures related to healthy living. They looked at people who never smoked, who had a BMI less than 30, who performed 3.5 hours a week or more of exercise and ate a healthy diet. These individuals were found to have a 78% lowered risk of developing a chronic disease, which was defined as myocardial infarction, stroke, cancer, or diabetes, and the risk was reduced for each of these diseases individually, as reported in the paper. Well, let's spend some slides talking about the Cochrane collaboration. Certainly an important initiative, and having overlap with the informatics world. So what is the Cochrane Collaboration? Well, it's an international collaboration with the aim of preparing and maintaining systematic reviews of the effects of healthcare interventions. So the only focus, or the main focus, of the Cochrane Collaboration is on interventions and not diagnosis, harm, unless the harm takes place in the context of an intervention or prognosis. So the Cochrane Collaboration is the largest producer in the world of systematic reviews. There's information, including the abstracts of all the reviews that the Cochrane Collaboration has produced, on their website at www.cochrane.org. There have been many articles written about the Cochrane Collaboration. One of the more recent ones published in Annals of Internal Medicine, so one of the major medical journals, was written by Levin in 2001. The main product of the Cochrane Collaboration is the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews. And the Cochrane Collaboration and the database get their names from a British physician, Archie Cochrane, who stated in 1972 that it's surely a great criticism of our profession that we've not organized a critical summary by specialty or subspecialty, adapted periodically, of all relevant randomized controlled trials. So Archie Cochrane had this vision of medicine summarizing all of its information such that it was easily accessible. So the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews, the Cochrane Collaboration, embodies the vision that Archie Cochrane had. Now, the Cochrane Collaboration has been a mostly volunteer effort, and it has produced about 2,000 systematic reviews in about a decade of existence. But the 2,000 reviews only cover a fraction of medicine and do not cover medicine really on a comprehensive basis. And many people wonder whether truly how sustainable the Cochrane Collaboration and its database and other products will be. So what is in a Cochrane review? Well, again, it's a systematic review. So there's a statement of the clinical problem or question. There's the sources of evidence, which evidence is typically gathered from a literature search. A small number of Cochrane reviews will also include non-experimental data, although that's somewhat controversial. Most of them do not. The inclusion and exclusion criteria for evidence are stated. The results are presented in both tabular and graphical form in a variety of ways. There's then the conclusions that come from the review. If there's a meta-analysis, the results of the meta-analysis will be described. And then, because Cochrane reviews are meant to be more of a database rather than a static document, there's the date of last update, both the last time anything was done as well as the last substantive update, so the last time significant new evidence was added to the review. So the Cochrane reviews are meant to be dynamic, living documents, not just a review that gets published in a journal somewhere and maybe it gets updated a few years later. The goal is for the Cochrane reviews to be continuously updated. We can learn more about what are in Cochrane reviews by focusing on the logo of the Cochrane Collaboration. In the center of the logo is a meta-analysis, and most Cochrane reviews have a meta-analysis, though they don't all. And the one in the Cochrane review is actually a meta-analysis that looks at the use of steroid treatment in preterm labor. So when babies are delivered prematurely, oftentimes their lungs are not mature, and there were a number of studies that gave either conflicting or inconclusive results a couple decades ago as to the benefit of giving steroids to increase the maturity of the fetal lung so that the baby would have a better chance of surviving when born prematurely. So in a meta-analysis, we typically have these horizontal lines, each of which represents a single trial. The span of the line indicates the confidence interval of that trial. The vertical line indicates the either odds ratio equals 1 or weighted mean difference equals 0 line. So basically, if a study has its result and confidence interval completely to the left of the vertical line, then that indicates the treatment is of benefit. If the confidence interval crosses the vertical line, that means the results are statistically inconclusive. So what happened with steroids and preterm labor was that there were a number of small studies that had not, that individually had not achieved statistical significance. But when they were combined in a meta-analysis, the results were pretty convincing. That you see the diamond there, and the width of the diamond is the confidence interval. It doesn't touch the odds ratio equals 1 line, so this meta-analysis showed fairly convincingly that there was benefit for giving steroids to a woman in preterm labor to increase the maturity of the fetal lungs and lead to a better outcome for the fetus. Well, there are other sources of summarized evidence besides the Cochrane reviews. There are many meta-analyses that are scattered about the medical literature. There are also the evidence reports that are produced from the dozen evidence-based practice centers that are funded by the Agency for Healthcare Research Quality. Our department at OHSU is home to one of the evidence-based practice centers, and these centers produce systematic reviews. There are also many sources of synopses available. We'll talk about these a little bit more in Unit 7, but you may have seen the publication Clinical Evidence, which bills itself as an evidence formulary, and they draw on Cochrane reviews and other syntheses and individual studies to essentially summarize the evidence. Another resource is InfoPoems, with POEMS standing for Patient-Oriented Evidence That Matters, which also is a collection of synoptic evidence. And then another effort is the peer resource, the Physicians Information and Education resource from the American College of Physicians, which is available both directly from the ACP and has also been licensed by StatRef, which is a value-added electronic publisher. So there are many ways of accessing summarized evidence. Well, of course, our discussion would not be complete if we didn't mention some of the limitations of systematic reviews and summarizing evidence. There are some people who believe that the use of meta-analysis is misguided. Alvin Feinstein is a well-known epidemiologist who has written in many places his concern about meta-analysis, and he's actually called it statistical alchemy. We do sometimes see meta-analyses on the same topic, including many of the same studies, but reaching different conclusions for a variety of methodologic reasons, the way they're done. One study also looked at the so-called half-life of knowledge, how quickly knowledge became overturned in the domain of liver disease, and meta-analysis actually had the shortest half-life. So when something was found to be the truth by meta-analysis, that truth lasted a shorter period of time than something discovered in a randomized controlled trial. And, of course, publication bias may be exacerbated in systematic reviews because systematic reviews, in essence, are a sampling of studies and they represent the spectrum of research done on a given topic. If there is publication bias, then the systematic reviews are going to be more compromised because they rely on information being appropriately published. And when there is publication bias, that may lead us to have incorrect conclusions from systematic reviews.